Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Now we present part 6 of the great Revelo Pendleton Oliver's Reflections on the Christ Myth. Thoughtless Christian conservatives, though having sound instincts that tell them that brown Muslims coming into our living space is not a good idea, refuse to see that it is the racial difference that is paramount, and think they can avoid being called racists by the Jews and their allies, good luck with that, by concentrating their fire on Islam. These extreme right, as anyone who is not 100% on board with white replacement is called by the Jew-dominated media, Christians fail to see the truth that is staring them in the face. Like Islam, their own religion, Christianity, is one head of a three-headed hydra descended from the Jews' ancient Yahweh cult, and has embedded in it numerous poisonous ideas that guarantee our defeat at the hands of the Jews, including 1. All races are one in God and are therefore equal. 2. The Jews are our spiritual ancestors. 3. The Jews' ancient scribblings and ravings are the Word of God. And 4. The Jews' vicious tribal deity, Yahweh, created the universe, is the father of Jesus, and is therefore our God too. None of these things are true. These pious conservatives also know next to nothing about the religion they excoriate so often, nor the intrigues involving the Jews surrounding it at its very beginnings. For that matter, neither do most Muslims. Dr. Oliver is here to correct these errors and help us face the realities we must face if we are to survive as a people. And so, we present part 6 of Reflections on the Christ Myth by Dr. Revelo P. Oliver. Listen.
As Christianity is divided between Catholics and Protestants, so there are 2 main divisions of Islam: the Sunnis, who follow tradition, Sunnah, and the Shia, the party of Ali, who have a different prophetical tradition. Both of these major divisions, needless to say, are split into a large number of sects. Muhammad is said to have predicted that his religion would be split into 73 competing sects. That may have been the number when the prophecy was forged. I shall not try to enumerate, describe, and distinguish the varieties of Muslim theology. That would take all the pages of Liberty Bell magazine for the rest of the year. There are sects of the Shia in many parts of the Muslim world, but that great division is centered in Persia, now called Iran, where the doctrines of the Shia have long been incorporated in government. The recent revolution, which brought Khomeini to power, deposed the Shah on the grounds that he, who was the servant of the occulted Imam, had become a heretic and thus disqualified himself for his sacred office. As I mentioned in a much earlier article, at the time of the revolution against the Shah of Persia, it was reported that the Khomeini who returned to Persia was not the Khomeini who had come thence to Paris as a refugee. I never learned what was the basis or origin of that report. In AD 878, the Imam who was the 12th in the series of divinely ordained successors of Muhammad, disappeared in a mosque at Samarra, retiring from the world, and going into hiding, occultation, under that building or elsewhere, whence, when the time is ripe and he feels like it, he will return and conquer the world for true believers. This is the faith now held in Iran. There is a sect of the Shia, the Ismailia, that holds that the seventh Imam was the last. They naturally split into subsects and are now represented by various scattered groups, including, I am told, some now active in Lebanon. In their prime, in the 9th and 10th centuries, however, they were a major power in Islam, having been organized as one of the world's greatest secret conspiratorial societies by a certain Abdullah, the son of Maymun al-Qadda, an occultist who practiced in Jerusalem and is said to have been a converted Jew. Abdullah and his coadjutor Karmat, who gave his name to the sect, made the secret society, which much after served as a model for Weishaupt's Illuminati, a conspiracy that aimed at the establishment of out-and-out Bolshevism and one world in which there would be no discrimination, since all races and all religions were equal and all mankind should enjoy perfect brotherhood and equality. In servitude to the hidden masters of the conspiracy, of course. Being extremely righteous, they naturally promoted social good with secret assassinations and open terrorism. They organized niggers to revolt against white people and massacre them for social justice. The Carmathians were temporarily brought under control, except in Egypt, but their conspiracy, with its twin techniques of underground subversion and terrorism, was revived in the 12th and 13th centuries, when it was known to the Western world as the Order of Assassins. It is only reasonable to suppose that many converted Jews were active in the perennial conspiracies and may have supplied the most effective agitators and secret agents. Yahweh's race has a special and incomparable talent for such humanitarian work. When Muhammad's religious revolution got underway in AD 622, the Jews had been preying on the Arabs for about 12 centuries. It is virtually certain that the last king of Babylon, Nabonidus, Nabonaid, installed the predatory race in the commercially strategic oases of the Arabian Peninsula shortly before they betrayed him and his nation into the hands of Cyrus the Great of Persia in the 6th century BC, when Cyrus rewarded them, as the British were to do 25 centuries later, by permitting a contingent of Jews to establish themselves in Palestine and start kicking the inhabitants around. The Jews in Mecca and Medina helped Muhammad at first, when he seemed merely to be creating local turmoil, but naturally had their own ends in view. And when Muhammad, like Luther, belatedly discovered that they were using him against his own people, he became wary. He frustrated a plot of the Jews to betray him to his enemies during the siege of Medina. And he executed some 600 of the treacherous brood in an atrocity about which the international predators still wail when they think it expedient. Muhammad's religion unified the Arab tribes and started them on their amazing conquest of a large part of the world. During his lifetime, he was the prophet of God, and the great military expeditions were commanded by men who formed a small oligarchy. And when he died, elected Abu Bakr as the caliph, khalifa, ruler of the newly formed state, and so ex officio commander-in-chief of the armies, it being assumed, naively, that the religion had been forever fixed by the Quran and the Prophet's recorded pronouncements. When Abu Bakr died, Umar was elected his successor, and he in turn was succeeded by Uthman. It was accepted that the next in the line of succession would be Ali, the husband of Fatima, Muhammad's daughter. It was at this point that a Jew, Abdullah ibn Sabah, was converted to Islam, and in obedience to his racial instincts, immediately began to make trouble by paying quasi-divine honors to Ali, which at least at first acutely embarrassed that man, and proclaiming that Ali, as Muhammad's heir, had been intended by God to be Muhammad's successor. With typically Yiddish industry, he traveled about the Muslim world, enlisting notables in a conspiracy to help God carry out his intention. Although there is no proof, it is a reasonable inference that the enterprising Sheeny arranged the assassination of Uthman, having in some way acquired an ascendancy over Aisha, who had been the favorite wife of Muhammad, and who, as a widow, was implicated in the conspiracy and assassination. After the murder of Uthman, Ali, the already designated successor, became the fourth and last of the Orthodox caliphs. Abdullah's party, Shia, however, continually stirred up trouble with claims that the first three caliphs had been usurpers, since they held command in violation of God's will, and that the succession must always go by heredity to the descendants of Ali. Aisha now joined in a conspiracy against Ali, which paradoxically undertook to avenge the murder of Uthman, and thus precipitated a civil war in which, no doubt, the parasitic race profited as usual from the losses of both sides. When Ali was assassinated, his succeeding son was still a stripling, but was recognized as the legitimate caliph by the Shia, which, when he was killed in battle, proceeded to maintain that the office of Imam, the divinely ordained religious head of Islam, and also ruler of the state, must descend by heredity in the family of Ali, thus assuring perpetual civil war in Islam. Now, I do not mean to imply that without the intervention of the converted Jew, there would not have been, sooner or later, violent contests over succession within the caliphate. And without Abdullah, there would doubtless have been an endless succession of doctrinal heresies, such as are simply normal in evangelical religions. His heresy was carried on by true Muslims, and I may exaggerate in seeing a distinctively Jewish trait in the Shiite doctrine of taqiyya, dissimulation, which authorizes members of the sect to profess different and even antithetical beliefs whenever they deem it expedient. But how Jewish that is. The success of the Shia in attaining a permanent base in Persia and dominating that country was less a consequence of religious doctrine than of racial disparity. The people of Persia at the time of the Arab conquest retained a large element of Aryan blood, thought of themselves as Aryans, Iran means land of the Aryans, and spoke an Indo-European language. They resented their Semitic conquerors, by whom they were forced to accept the Semitic religion, and the heresy Abdullah had founded gave them a way of opposing the orthodoxy of Semitic Muslims. In the end, they thus succeeded in making Persia independent of the rest of Islam. I think it neatly symbolic, however, that the modern Iran became available to Jewish manipulation as the result of a politico-religious sedition begun by a member of their versipellis and insatiable race. Abdullah need not have operated by an elaborate plan. He simply applied instinctively his race's normal technique, which was set forth in the Jew book and presumably approved by all Christians. Yahweh, who promised to help his chosen bandits destroy all the people whose country they invaded, describes his method specifically in the screed called Isaiah, Hesias, 19:2, where Yahweh promises to set Egyptian against Egyptian and make the Goyim kill one another in a glorious civil war for the profit of his chosen predators. Egyptian, of course, stands for any nation of Goyim God's people want to invade and exploit. And for that matter, after they had, by instinct or calculation, infected our race with the Christian superstition, they had, century after century, the joy of watching the despised and hated Aryans butcher one another over figments of theologians' perverted imaginations.